adventuring.
Hooray, guys, welcome. We're here.
I want to tell all our listeners why we might sound a little different this week.
Yeah,
go for it.
Some changes.
We've been going through puberty. I've been going through it real hard.
Yeah, this is secondary puberty.
It's because there's a cold snap in Minnesota where we're recording, and it's negative a billion below zero, and none of us want to leave the house. Yeah, we've reached absolute zero.
Yes. It is negative a billion below zero, so that's like double negative. It is double negative temperatures.
Not proper English, but properly cold.
Yes. A proper description.
So we're all Skyping in this week because we don't want to die when we leave our homes.
Yeah, it's a pretty important consideration.
In case you don't know, this show is for Magic amateurs and other people who enjoy the game of Magic, but also amateurs. I'm Maria, one of your hosts, along with Megan and Ben.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
And you guys, this week we have an awesome special guest.
Shut up.
I won't.
You shut your mouth.
You guys, I won't. Or I will, but only to allow our special guest time to talk.
Oh, okay. Who is it, Megan?
His name is Greg.
Hey, Greg. Say hi.
Hi, everyone.
His full name is Greg Ogrins.
Ooh,
Greg Ogrins.
Well done.
Yeah.
There we go. Right. I got it right.
I know. Greg,
Greg, how cold is it where you are?
It is also very, very cold. Oh, I'm from Wisconsin, so it's not much different over here. There are a lot of schools that were closed. Particularly, I live in Milwaukee. Milwaukee public schools were all closed because a lot of people have to walk or like wait for their buses and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they didn't want any children outside.
I saw a school in Minneapolis that was just encased in a large block of ice.
That was really problematic. They just couldn't get in.
Yeah.
It was like it had been dropped in a giant ice cube. So Greg recently came second in GP Toronto. So congratulations, Greg.
Thank you.
Yay.
That is super awesome. That is super real awesome.
And he did well in a PTQ.
Yes. But I did well. We mean won.
He won it. That's the best well you can do.
Yes.
That is
the most well. So, for the noobs.
Setting goals.
Yeah. Goals are important things to set.
Why? Make me.
Yeah, Megan, why? Defend your position.
Well, because when you set goals, then you're going to try to accomplish them. And hopefully you picked goals that are good goals and not terrible goals.
Okay. Should I make a magic vision board?
I mean, you could.
Ooh.
Hold on. I'm not going to stop you.
Do you have a regular vision board?
I have every aspect of my life has a vision board.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of vision boarding.
Yeah, I got to see that sometime.
I've got one for my daily routine. So I've got like a shower vision board. So I like picture, I've got a picture of shampoo and conditioner. I just want to make sure it happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's totally fair.
So what kind of goals should people maybe think about setting for themselves in Magic?
Well, I mean, in my mind, there's short-term goals, which we've talked about in the past, and then there's long-term goals. Was it Gate Crash? I think Ben set a goal of winning at least one draft with each of the guilds.
Right.
So that's an example of a short-term guild, or a short-term goal.
Ben, did you accomplish that goal?
I think so.
I think you did too.
I'll have to check my records.
Okay. And a long-term goal?
Yeah. You know, guys, I don't really have any long-term goals right now. I don't have an example to give you.
Ben?
I think a good example of a long-term goal is, maybe you want to hit a specific win rate. At draft, for example, like you want to win a certain percentage of your drafts. or maybe you want to day two a Grand Prix, or you want to qualify for the Pro Tour, or you really want to beat your brother. I think any of those is a perfectly good long-term goal.
What if I don't have a brother?
Then that's going to be a hard goal. That's probably the wrong goal.
You have to get
a brother and then beat him.
You can borrow Ben's brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not really a brother, so I would have to convince my mom to have another child. This is real long term.
This is
super long term.
Ambitious.
Greg, are you accustomed to setting goals for yourself magic wise?
Sure. Yeah, I also like goals. Typically I'm interested in setting goals that are both ambitious, but attainable. Things that I can actually have an effect on the outcome. So setting a goal when it comes to like a PTQ season of obviously trying to win a PTQ, but you have to top 8 a PTQ to win it.
Right.
So I will set goals on usually the number of top 8s or on like maybe even smaller term than that, like trying to like understand a meta game and things like that. I'm very goal oriented when it comes to thinking about seasons and things like that in terms of planeswalker points. Am I going to be able to get some of my friends to meet threshold? I always hit the magic, whatever it is, 1500 or 1700. I play a lot of magic, but if I can get some of my friends to hit some of those goals, then I'm more likely to get people to travel to bigger tournaments with me, and I'm more likely to have fun. So
oh wow,
nice. Yeah. I like the joining of the like getting your friends.
Yeah. Oh, it's well huge. Well, I mean, like, we all play magic for different reasons, right? So for me, I'm extraordinarily competitive, and I want to play against the best players I possibly can. And that also means that I want like my friends to get better, so that when I'm playing during the week, I'm challenged. I have more fun from the standpoint of that challenge, and also I get to spend time with my friends. So it's sometimes harder to get people that aren't as motivated to travel to tournaments to do that. And one way that you can do that is if they start to get a taste of some success. It's a lot easier to convince people to spend money on plane tickets or weekends on road tripping to tournaments.
Yeah, absolutely. You just have to give them that first little sweet taste of success, and you've got them hooked.
Yeah.
What I do is I dangle a little Debbie snack cake out in front of Megan when she plays.
Yeah.
And if she wins, she can take a bite.
It's really effective. It's really great.
Well, that's an example of a short-term goal.
Yeah, there you go.
Short-term goal.
Too long-term.
Little bite of a little Debbie snack cake, short-term goal. Eating the whole little Debbie snack cake at 1 FNM, long-term goal.
It looks really weird, everybody, but it works like a charm.
It really works.
Ben had a goal similar to this, I think, in that he roped Megan and I into playing this game.
Yeah, my goal is to get 2 people addicted per year.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who are you working on this year? Is it Drew? Is it Drew and someone else?
Yeah, totally.
You may have heard heard us talking to Drew in our last episode. We were doing a live episode in front of a studio audience. Listen to that, episode 53, if you're interested in hearing us record with humans in the same room.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nice. So, Greg, you mentioned getting people, like, getting friends to join you because it also makes travel easier and more enjoyable. How much do you travel in a season, do you think?
So, think of, the most that you could imagine, like, practically imagine a person traveling. I travel more than that.
Okay.
I have a full-time job. My profession is not magic. However... because I'm a Java developer, I'm a computer programmer. Sure. I get paid really well to work actually regular hours. So I have my evenings and weekends and also some amount of vacation to spend on whatever else I want to do. And I like to play Magic. But as I mentioned earlier, against like the highest level competition I possibly can. So I go to all of the North American Grand Prix.
All of them?
Yes.
How many is that in a year?
What?
Much more the last year and a half.
it's almost been one a week.
It's not really one a week in North America. But it certainly went from when I first started traveling to tournaments, it was once every other month, which was very manageable. It was very manageable. And then I decided, well, why would I not go to one? It was more of a challenge that I didn't have a response to. So I started going to all of them, and that was about once a month. And then they increased the schedule. So now there are stretches where there are like three or four consecutive weekends where there are Grand Prix. So sometimes it's like it seems like every week. Fortunately for my wallet and also sanity, it is not literally every week that there's a Grand Prix. But I'm traveling almost every week otherwise for Magic, because I certainly still like to PTQ when I'm not qualified. And when it's local and not very sub-degree temperature, I'll travel to SCGs.
Okay. Do you have as many sky miles as George Clooney in that one movie where he flies in a plane?
No, not at all. Okay. So the way that, like, the short version on that, you have to travel much further than I do. Being in the Midwest, I don't actually get a lot of miles very often. Like, the most that I'm flying to is one of the coasts, and that's not, like, in one trip, that's not even the same as a one-way from one coast to the other. So if you lived in either coast and traveled a lot, you pick up a lot of miles very quickly. And if you travel internationally.
You got to move to Hawaii.
Well, or travel for work. So I don't have to fly every weekend. I only fly to Grand Prix typically. And if I've got a bunch of local players that are interested in going to a Grand Prix, I'm more likely to road trip because then I'm going with other people.
That's nice. Although you'll experience this being in Wisconsin. There are, in the Midwest, not a ton of awesome places you can drive to.
No, it's sort really of like, just a few hours, and they're almost all south. There isn't really – you can't really drive north any number of hours because there are lakes and Canada, and there's not –
there's no Grand Prix on the Upper Peninsula.
Everyone remembers the Great Lake Superior Grand Prix, though, right?
It was
on the boat in Lake Superior.
That was so cool. Sleeves were really more important than usual.
Yeah, exactly. And if you, as soon as you dropped, they threw you into the lake and you had to swim back to shore.
It was a literal drop.
Yeah.
You had to walk a plank.
You shouldn't have walked.
I wish I had 10% of this inside joke.
We're just making up this joke
so you go
fair. So I am like every other listener, as opposed to a joke from like episode 25 or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're just as lost as all of our listeners.
Who are like, why were they talking about a lake?
So Greg, what kind of goals did you set for yourself when you went into, say, GP Toronto when you took second, or the PTQ when you won?
So, the PTQ, all right, both of those tournaments are examples of tournaments that I came in very confident. I go to a lot of tournaments, and I'm not very confident for the vast majority of them, honestly. So, taking a step back, I draft in my apartment, with people like coming and visiting me at least twice a week, which is a lot of drafting. So when it comes to limited events, I am on the upper echelon of people that are prepared for an event because I have a lot of repetition with good limited players. When it comes to constructed events, I don't, because I'm working during the week, I don't have a lot of opportunities to play online or play in local events or watch things. So I get to pay a little bit of attention to coverage and who did what well, what decks did well, and things like that. And then I do some playtesting. But the amount of hours that I have with a constructed deck is typically a lot less than the majority of the people that are at a given tournament that maybe don't play every week but prepare for a couple weeks on end for one tournament. So so I don't have the same kind of confidence, and though I do well at some of those tournaments, it's not the same as either of those examples, whereas the PTQ was the first limited PTQ of the season, and it was an M14 format. So I hadn't played in a whole lot of sealed events, but I knew all of the cards and knew the draft format really, really, really well. So what I tried to do is I just tried to put myself in a position to take advantage of the format that I knew. So I in terms of preparation, I prepare for limited kind of the same way. I just build sealed decks. Anytime anybody goes to a pre-release or a release or goes to some sealed event, they typically will bring those sealed pools, shuffle them up, and then hand them to me. And then in a kind of crowded room, I will take the deck and try and build it however I would. And then after I'm done with building it, either the way that I would or when there's a timer usually. When the timer gets done, I stop, and then we talk about what they did versus what I did and why maybe I was wrong or maybe something that they hadn't seen, and then we talk about how the event actually went. And that's a form of preparation that we do either right before or right after a draft. So I hadn't had any real experience firsthand of building sealed decks for that format, but I, like I said, knew the format I think as well as anybody else. And then when I was in a position to actually draft it, I was probably one of the most confident people in the room. Didn't drop a game. It was a very, very fun event because as I was drafting it, I don't know if you guys played a lot of M14. But blue was very good.
Blue was incredibly good.
I was allowed to draft a mono blue deck. So I Holy after the draft
snap.
Mono.
Yeah, yes. After the draft, before games, we were forced to go to our corner of the room to build our deck, and then before the first match, I went to the restroom and I had a handful of high fives as I'm walking to the restroom from people that were there for the PTQ that were going to be driving to Chicago or Minnesota, because the room, at least in terms of my friends, and I had a lot there, knew that I was in a really good position, and I didn't squander it, fortunately.
Did you kind of feel like you couldn't lose when you had that deck?
I felt what I yes.
That is the best feeling.
I can't even imagine a mono blue draft deck in M14. That sounds disgusting.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could describe it to you, but you you wouldn't believe me.
Yes, that sounds awesome.
Double opportunity. I had a clone. it was great.
So was the Toronto GP a limited event as well, or no?
Yes. So. Toronto, similar to Sacramento that's coming up, was all Theros limited. So I just felt like on the first day I needed to make it through the sealed portion, similar to that other PTQ. I needed to make it past the first portion, which is though I don't believe it's nearly as pool dependent as a lot of people in general think Sealed is. You really can't do well with completely awful cards. You can, however, take a mediocre pool and be successful with it. So fortunately, I had a mediocre or a little bit better than that pool, and I built it incorrectly. I ran out of time. I'm a very deliberate player, so I spent a lot of time. and when the person during the sleep-in special said you have 1 minute, I was like, well, I don't have lands together for the version that's in front of me yet, so I guess I have to register this and then go and talk to my friends and find out what I can do, because I had a are you guys familiar with the Scholar of Athros, the 1/4 white creature?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so that guy is particularly good in Sealed. But it looks like a white creature, but it's actually a black creature. If you can only activate him or her, Scholar, I don't remember what the picture looks like.
It's a lady.
Okay. Oh, man.
It's totally a lady.
So if you can only activate her once, you're not really getting a lot, especially as the game goes late. If you're only activating her one time, what you're getting is very small, unless you just happen to be mana screwed. But if you're reliably only able to get one activation, it's probably not worthwhile. So in Sealed and in draft, I really look at the card like a black card that can certainly be in a black-white deck, or it can be in a deck that splashes white, but not a deck that splashes black. So my mostly green build with the one in a green enchantment that enchants a land that I can't think of the name of, Nylea's Presence, there we go, with my Presence deck, didn't quite find a way of getting that card in initially, but then after handing the pool to a handful of my friends that were in Toronto, we came up with a build that allowed me to play the two of that card that I had, and having two of that in Sealed, I think, is a card that really lends itself well in the late games, and I had a lot of ways of living that long with double Scorpion and stuff like that. So fortunately, I managed to make it through day one of Toronto, which was awesome. I had, like, I was 8-1, so I managed to last through day one without two losses, let alone three to knock me out. So
yeah,
I
nice. You didn't even have, like, the stress factor
of
being like, I'm two losses in. To me, that sounds like a nightmare. Like,
yeah, I actually lost my – this happens fairly frequently with me. I actually lost the first round that I played, which is in the fourth round. So I came off with three buys, lost the first one, and was pretty confident that it was due to a sideboarding mistake. And that was pretty par for the course for me. Very unfortunate, but I have difficulty getting going at the beginning of tournaments, getting my head game focusing.
Maybe
like that.
You should dangle a little Debbie out in front of yourself.
Well, it's not from a will standpoint. It's not from a lack of desire, but it's from a lack of focus. I haven't. I will oftentimes not play enough games with my deck, and I won't be as familiar with exactly what my 40 cards look like, and I think that's a pretty important thing whenever whether you've got one buy or three. If you've got any time from when you actually build your deck till the time where you play your first round, that time should be focused on that deck. It's a lot harder when you've got not much time to really be able to utilize that. And if you have zero buys, you're in for a lot of magic as it is. So hopefully you can get that experience in while you're in the first round or two, without losing. But I had more time than that, so I don't have any excuse really. I lost there, and then managed to win the rest of my matches on the first day, which is huge. Nice. The difference between 7-2 and 8-1 is considerable when you're going into day two of a Grand Prix. Realistically, if you 7-2, you get to draft twice, but you don't even have the ability to unintentionally draw once. You have to win all of your matches the next day. And the reason has to do with like tiebreakers and stuff like that. But you're actually kind of out of the tournament even though you day two when you 7-2.
Okay.
At least from the standpoint
like,
of top
in terms of like yeah, running, like you can't top
there's
it.
There's still a lot you can do. Yeah. It's not that you can't, it's that it's just very, very, very hard. So when you start to put together some wins, if you get into the middle of the day and you are still at one or zero losses, you should really be, you know, doubling down on your focus and doing everything you can to try and keep it together, because before you have two losses, you're still alive to not just do well, but maybe even, you know, like top eight that tournament. It's still possible, and it's not just like unlikely, but it's still something that you can achieve. So when I ended day one at 8-1, I was more than happy. I wasn't just oh yes, because I day two a lot of Grand Prix. I play a lot of high level Magic, and I've only entered day two at 8-1 just a handful of times. I've 7-2'd a lot of tournaments, and I've managed to do really well the few times that I've 8-1'd, and don't think that it's a coincidence at all.
Hey
really.
Ben.
Hi.
Yeah.
Is Ben here?
Yeah, he's here. I wonder if Ben has any questions for Greg.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just monologuing and pretty off the topic of goals.
<That's okay. laughs> No. I think so. My takeaways are: you focus a lot on deck building practice, and you've got sort of a group that you'll discuss deck building decisions with.
Absolutely.
And so you know, when you get into a position, like I'm sure you must. There must be times when you're arguing over a certain card with someone, right?
Yep.
How do you know when, like, do you ever have a moment when you realize you were wrong, like they were right? And how do you know when you need to stand your ground and when someone else has something you can use that you can learn from?
So a few things that I want to take a step back. Because I think that that's a great question, not just a good one, but actually a great question.
Thank you. I'm well known.
Oh God! Now you've
Ben,
done it.
You guys, Greg, you do not need to encourage them. You do not need to encourage them.
One thing that I'd like to highlight about what I do and what a couple of other communities that I respect greatly in terms of their preparation practices are I don't just play a lot of Magic. I don't just like run through a lot of repetitions. I actually play zero Modo. Like I have an account. I've played zero games of Constructed or Limited Magic on Modo. Yes. Okay. So, I think that there was some thing you get when you spend $10 to get your account, and I played one game with that like starter something.
You got your like new player points, and you went in and you wrecked
I was
a
like,
bunch
oh,
of.
This is a thing. Anyway, and don't misunderstand. I am not at all advocating for not playing Modo or anything like that. But I want to underscore the fact that I am not about playing as much Magic as you possibly can and just
right.
going through repetition after repetition. Because if you're playing Magic by yourself on a computer against some random person, when you make a mistake or when you do something well, all you have to be able to identify whether or not you made a mistake or doing something that's particularly well are the little bit of feedback you might get from your likely troll of an opponent, And by that, I mean that not that they are a troll and they live somewhere, but they're like the only time that people often will interact with somebody they don't know online is if they did something that they think is worthy of complaining about.
Maria gets the most of that. Maria has several excellent stories of people who...
She's a troll magnet.
She's a troll magnet.
In real life and online, am I right, ladies?
Holla.
So anyway, not to derail. I don't want to spend a lot of time on Moto, but my point is simply that the only people that are interacting are you and another person that you can't read unless they are like talking to you. And a lot of the time, they don't. So you don't actually have a whole lot of ability to get feedback when you do things well or poorly. It's really just like spending time and like hopefully you're paying attention, you're looking for things that you did well or that you didn't, and hopefully you're finding things, but there's not a lot of opportunity for that feedback. When you are playing in person, you have a lot of opportunity for feedback. Whether it's that, whether you're seeking it or not, whether you are good with feedback or not, you have at least one opponent that can tell you if you did something that was strange. You played a spell, you know, something really basic. You played a spell that targeted the wrong thing, or you played it in a poor sequence. If you had attacked first, maybe they wouldn't have blocked with that one creature they had, and instead of spending a removal spell before combat, you could actually do something else with your mana or something. You know, there's not, you know, whatever. I advocate a lot for in-person magic, but not just against random people that may or may not provide you any feedback, but with your friends. And cultivate an environment where feedback is not just supported, not just acceptable, but highly encouraged. So I said earlier that I draft at least twice a week in my apartment. I have a by invite group where I invite typically the best players I possibly can from my local and a little bit more regional. Some people drive kind of far, but I try and get the best players I possibly can, and some players that aren't necessarily the best but have shown that they are open for criticism and open to criticize in a way that is constructive and not just troll focused.
Sure.
So as a result, and also the fact that I'm one of a couple of limited communities that advocate for team drafting exclusively, what I'll have is an opportunity every single time that I draft to be able to sit down with the people that were randomly chosen, because we don't just play with like my two best friends or something like that, or the two best players I can in the room, but I'll have 8 players sit down, we'll draft with random seedings, and then after the draft, I'll randomly pick a set of 4-on-4, and we'll know the one person from the other team you don't play, and me and my 3 random people at the table will go into a separate room of my apartment and close the door, and we will make our decks side by side and talk about everything we possibly can.
So I get
feedback and give feedback from basically the beginning of like when the actual draft portion has ended until the end of the draft. Now, we don't talk about, because it can very easily devolve into the best person on a team playing all of the matches. We don't talk about plays in advance in terms of you can't play a game for another person on your team. But you can talk about sideboard decisions. You can talk about mulligan decisions. And one thing that we have evolved and what we do currently and have done for a few months now is that any form of feedback is fair game. It can be instant. It just has to be feedback, not future play advice. So what that means is that if I make a mistake, and a person that's on my team is already done with their match, or they're between sideboarding, or they just happen to be paying attention, they say, I don't think that you should have played that card. I think you should have played this card, or I don't think that you should have targeted that, or whatever it may be. And after doing that a lot, you start to get a feel for, well, why? And or you ask why. And that conversation ends up developing, and you end up just, like, as long as you're focused on trying to make sure that the pace of play within the draft does not suffer, you're actually playing kind of fast. You're not spending hours and hours on every draft because it's not devolving into long conversations. You have a lot of opportunities to give and get feedback. And if somebody in the group is really bad at giving feedback, they're just extraordinarily rude. Typically, because it's my apartment, I kind of set the pace. I will usually have a conversation with them and say, realistically, you've got to improve the way that you communicate with people, or I'm not going to invite you back.
Nice.
And as a result, the community that I have cultivated, and it is almost all of the best players I can get in my community. It isn't all of them, because some of the best players are jackass. they can't turn it off. They just don't know how. And some of them were jackasses that have learned to, like, at least here, change the way that they interact with other people. And as a result, the community is, I think, outstanding. I have taken a couple of my local like draft players to bigger events, and one of them top-8ed his first PTQ. The first PTQ that he played in, he top-8ed.
Wow.
Nice. That sounds
so. Yeah. So, like, I know that there's talent in the group, and that doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from having a lot of opportunities to provide and to receive feedback, because you're learning when you're providing feedback too. Because when somebody makes a particular, like, interesting play that you don't understand and you think they should have done blah, well, you explain why you do blah, and they say, oh, you're right, or they say, no, here's why I did it the way that I did.
And
people get better real fast.
And this is something, too, that if you're listening, you can take away and think about using in your own life.
Absolutely. I highly encourage anyone.
I mean, if you're making a play group, if you're having people over just to draft, I mean, why not try a team draft? Or if you're at your local store playing with your friends, remember to give encouraging feedback and critical feedback, but in a way that'll help your friend improve.
Oh, go ahead.
No, continue.
Oh, I was just going to say, and a bigger life lesson, let people know when they're being jackasses. because it will generally improve the quality of your playgroup, but also of your life.
Yeah, totally. So, Greg, I'm curious, in terms of numbers, how many people do you have, like, in a given session? And then, you know, do you have sort of a...
So it's always an even number. It's always an even number. I have certainly done 5-on-5s, so 10-person drafts. They are not particularly productive.
Nobody likes a 10-person draft.
There's a bunch of reasons. One is the fact that you just, like, the amount of – you're not seeing your pack as frequently. You're seeing a lot – like, the draft decks are much more highly varied. They're either a lot better or a lot worse, and they can potentially be a lot better on one side than the other side of the table and stuff like that, because you're seeing six more packs in the draft, and each person is seeing less of the packs that they were seeing before. So as a result, I don't like that from the standpoint of the actual drafts themselves. And also, it's a lot harder when you have five people on a team to really get the same kind of group consensus about certain decks. You end up really becoming kind of smaller pairs and things like that, where you're getting two people people's input on any particular thing, which is still good, but it's not as good, especially if there might become hurt feelings because somebody might not get asked for their input very often and stuff like that, and it just, you're not as likely to notice that. So anyway, I don't really like 10s. I will do 12 when it's not at my apartment, when it can actually be 2 6s. I certainly have done that, and it's totally fine. But it's never actually 12. It's 2 6s.
Sure.
and then yeah, it'll be 6 or 8 every single time. The way that I set it up is not necessarily the it can come off a little elitist because I am not like messaging a like 50 people and then seeing first come first serve. It's much more by invitation than that.
Sure.
But as a result,
because otherwise control on the numbers, it doesn't really work out with numbers. Yeah.
And also the reality is I want to, and this is, I understand this is selfish. I want to provide the best environment that I possibly can, and best involves a few things in communication. Is I think one of those key factors. So I want to get people that are comfortable, talking about things. So I value that highly. And if they're good at magic, then they're more likely to be able to provide stronger feedback. And as a result, we're just all going to get better. So so those are the numbers. What was your other question?
Oh, I'm wondering, like the larger pool of players that you would invite from, like how many are in that group? Is it 10 people, 30
sure.
people?
So the number of people, so because I'm a programmer, I'm kind of a stat guy, and I keep stats of every single draft.
Nice, nice.
So cool. I have I'm a little behind right now. I have a stack of a lot of little pieces of paper with who played who. That's another thing. We don't stop when there's a winning team. We play all of the rounds every single time.
Yeah.
No matter
what. For the practice.
Yes. Because
awesome.
The reality is if there's a slower deck, or there's a slower archetype, that particular archetype over the course of a season is going to get less games in, and you're going to know a lot less about how to build that particular archetype, what makes good versions of that archetype, what are bad versions of that archetype, if you're playing
yeah.
the archetype a lot less. So
yeah.
we don't want to do that. So we're always playing all of the rounds. So there isn't really a specific advantage of being quick, other than just that if you're slow, you're going to be pretty frustrating to play against, and that might have an impact on people's desire to play with you, and that can have an impact on my desire to invite you. But
nice.
that's something that can be addressed as well. You really can,
yeah.
can work on that kind of thing. So
you really have a setup going on. It's like the godfather of magic playing.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, I'm not the only one. There are a few communities. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of the Finkel draft. There's a group in New York that does something similar. They actually play less magic, but or with less frequency. They don't play even once a week anymore because all those guys are a little bit older and they have jobs and stuff like that. But they'll typically play when they play. They'll play both for money, and they'll play a few drafts at a time. They'll spend like a Saturday or something in draft.
I like that idea that they're playing for money.
Yeah,
that's kind of fun, like poker.
That's to do with your group. So I certainly would be willing to play for money every single time, but that's also because I have a pretty good paying job,
right.
And not all Magic players can afford to do that. And what I really don't want is to have one of some players that aren't necessarily employed and stuff like that. I don't want somebody to end up not coming to a draft because they can't afford to like the packs, or somebody to feel like they're pressured into playing for money. And that's something that happens to be important with my particular community that might vary in some other communities.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
I guess I didn't answer Ben's question. The number of people that like I will pull from, The honest answer is 50 plus. I have probably 200 Magic players in my phone.
Oh my gosh!
Because I live in there.
Everywhere.
So
I know
small.
People from each region that like go to each, you know, that go to a lot of Grand Prix and stuff like that. But in terms of locally, people that are still in the community, still actively interested in drafting, slash don't work on the nights that I or like go to have class or whatever else. It's probably 50 players. The number of people that have drafted in my apartment, that's certainly 100 players or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
But I mean, I've been doing it once or twice a week for over a year and a half of that. So, yeah.
Wow, it sounds like you have so many. You can probably like mix it up just to get feedback from different people. And...
Yes. There are a couple personalities that you understand when you bring them together. It's not that they can't work together, but there's friction for whatever reasons, and I typically decide I'm not gonna put both of those people in the same room anymore, because it's either going to create awkwardness during the draft or just not the same kind of productivity. So I will try not to limit my pool too much that way, but I will like choose to order who I'm inviting, or if like one of those people I ask early and they say no, I'm more likely to go to the other person pretty soon on that day when I'm texting people.
Yeah. So you do this more for draft than limited, right? That's what you said, or more for draft than constructed.
Yeah, this is it is, I don't do this at all for constructed. In terms of constructed preparation, a couple things. One, people that come for drafts will oftentimes bring decks. If there is a local, specifically if there's a local PTQ, there's a PTQ in a few hours driving distance, then those people are independently incentivized to prepare for the tournament, and they're going to want to bring their constructed decks with them. If there is something that's kind of important that's relatively local, we might take one of the days where I'm not drafting that are typically for my like date nights. I have a wife whom I need to spend like dedicated time, so I don't let my relationship decay. So sometimes we'll spend one of those other days. So I'll draft every Tuesday and Thursday. Friday I'm oftentimes already on my way to a tournament, so I'll be gone Friday to Sunday or sometimes Monday. And if I get back, if I'm getting back on Monday, I typically want Monday to be a day that's pretty dedicated to my wife because I hadn't seen her all weekend, etc. So I have Wednesday to play with sometimes that I can dedicate to Magic. So I'll either have a day where I invite just a couple people over to jam some games, especially if it's a tournament that I'm going to and other people aren't. Grand Prix specifically, I'm more likely to do something kind of small scale with people that are interested in learning about a format that they don't have any real investment in. But if there's a local tournament, then things are a little different, and we're more likely to have people bring decks with them to our draft, and we'll start a little bit before the draft, or people will stay for a couple hours after the draft. I typically only do one draft, which means that there's a lot more flexibility to rather than jamming a couple drafts together on a night. There's more time to be able to do some play testing after.
Right.
But a lot of these players are just limited fiends and can't get enough of drafting, but have no real interest in constructed. So
right.
There's not the same kind of hunger locally for constructed, except for a couple players. And I will, when there is a local event, or if there's an event that I think somebody that's really strong in constructed locally but doesn't draft as often, I'm more likely to invite them We're trying to get them to come out for a draft preceding a bigger constructed tournament, because then they're in an environment with a bunch of people that they want to be in with, talking with anyway, and we can get some input from them about that format. So that's something that I do tweak the who related to that, but I don't get as much constructed playtesting. I do know that there are communities like in Chicago. I have a bunch of friends that will get together a couple of times a week just to jam games of Standard, just like they have a gauntlet and they play, you know, they have like the 8 decks that they think are the best deck, and they'll play against each other, and they'll modify sideboards and stuff like that, and try and feel like, well, this is the best deck for this weekend. And then those guys are typically more SCG focused, so they'll travel, they'll leave on Friday and then go to whatever the closest SCG is. So it's a little bit different, because SCGs are always Standard and Legacy. It's a lot more easy to prepare from week to week when it's the same format, but SCGs until just starting this weekend, really only thing you could get out of SCGs, you know, you could top 8, you could make some money, but there's not a lot of money, and it just leads to their invitationals, and the invitationals are so much smaller in terms of both money and prestige than pro tours, because you're just talking about a lot less money. So
right.
it's different things. Anyway.
So I do have two more questions about Limited, and then Maria, maybe we can, then I'll throw it back to you guys. So sure. if you're practicing a certain draft format, at what point, like, is there a point in that process where you feel like you understand the draft format and you're like ready to compete with anyone at that draft format?
I guess I have kind of an odd response for you. So at two different times in the format. So there's a first point at the very beginning of the format. There is a time from when the first pre-release happens in my community in Milwaukee, to the point with which a Modo has the new set.
Okay.
During that window of time, the vast majority of Magic players have very little access to drafting the format.
Yeah.
It's basically like after like release weekend, like the Friday of the release, everybody is able to get product that they pre-ordered from their store, and you actually have the ability to draft at your local store and stuff like that. So people start to draft usually around then. Well, locally, it's a different world. Because I have a group of players that are very good at Limited and play a lot of Limited, on the pre-release weekend, we get a lot of packs. We play in a lot of pre-releases. It varies how many each of us plays. Some people will only play in like one or two, but then on the top end, some people will play in like 5 or 6 pre-releases. It's a big community. There are a lot of stores, and stores try not to fight too much on when their bigger events are. So you can get a lot of Magic in, and if you do well, you get packs. So we have packs within like my draft group before you can buy them. Not before you can win them, because we're getting them through winning, but we have a lot of product early. So when it's at the beginning of the format, it's really exciting, and there's this window before a pro tour where anybody who's qualified for that pro tour is incredibly incentivized to learn as much as possible, to understand as much as we possibly can. So locally in Milwaukee, that week between pre-release and release, we'll probably draft four times. And then on the release weekend, I'll actually, along with some of the very best players from Milwaukee, will typically go out of the city to another city and join about 25 to 30 other people from the Midwest region that are qualified for the Pro Tour before everybody goes to their like team testing. And we will do something called Draftapalooza, where we will draft all release weekend. Typically, I will leave on Friday after getting whatever product I purchased. I'll get like a case or something. So I will have whatever is left from pre-releasing that I got, and any product that I like ordered, which is oftentimes being used for the drafting that we do here. But then people have some stuff for a while from that, from their pre-releases and stuff. So I don't necessarily sell product to my players very often, but I'll take a bunch of product out to this Draftapalooza, and I'll get two or three drafts in on that Friday night. And then eventually we'll sleep for a few hours. And then at 10 a.m. on Saturday, we'll draft about five times and then five more times on Sunday. So by the Monday after the release weekend, I will have drafted in person like 15 to 20 times.
Holy cow.
That is more drafts than hardly anybody in the world. So as a result, I'm like almost arrogant about where about where I am with the format relative to at least everybody else. Don't necessarily think that I have it, but I probably think that I have it more than the people that have, you know, three or less drafts under their belt. Certainly how I've done during those drafts matters a lot. I am not a savant. Yeah. No, I don't know anyone who honestly is. Anybody that you think is good at Magic is good at Magic sometimes and bad at Magic sometimes. Everybody is. And
so you're saying even if you've drafted 15 times before it, if you like O3'd all of those, then you wouldn't be as confident going in.
Correct. I still am probably think that I can take three random players from a community after I hear the community and like where they come from. If they're not from what I know is a strong drafting community, I would take three random people, even if they are like pro players, and take two random people from my phone and draft for $100. Like I would do that very confidently, just because I would feel confident that I know enough about the format now at that point where even if I haven't put it together yet, that I can put it together better than people that have no real concept of what's going on yet. Because, I mean, with the exception of core sets, drafting is a lot about synergy. And there are certainly some linear strategies, but a lot of it is not intuitive, which is why the game is great. I would be confident, but not to the point of, you know, I'm hot shit. Like I can when I've had a phenomenal weekend. If I've had a phenomenal weekend against some of the people that I respect the most in terms of limited, I feel kind of unstoppable. So I actually, after Theros came out, for example. So this is after I'd won the M14 PTQ. I don't know if it was the next competitive REL event, but I went to Oklahoma City the weekend after the release. This was the weekend before the Pro Tour in Dublin. And I went and I brought a couple of friends from Milwaukee, And Oklahoma City was GP Oklahoma City was Theros, and I took 24th. I top 32'd Grand Prix Oklahoma City, and it was something that I felt really confident in. I didn't know that, you know, I didn't go into that event saying I'm going to top 8 this Grand Prix or anything crazy like that. But I was like, I think that if I can put it together better than, you know, the people that I play against during this sealed portion, I've got a real shot. And I, if I remember correctly, I was 7-2 with what I thought was a terrible sealed pool. I was like, well, I'm still alive here. Let's see how it goes. I feel real confident about the drafting format. I managed to 2-0-1. I unintentionally drew with somebody by the name of Trey Van Cleve, who's a person that you guys can Google after this, because he's, if you don't know, there's some funny stories about his Magic career, but he's a pretty nice guy. Unintentionally drew on camera to then be 2-0-1 for my first draft and be locked out of, or basically locked out of top 8 contention. Managed to 2-1 my second draft and top 32 because I had good breakers. So that was a result right after being, you know, really confident in that limited format. And then after the format, you know, after A, the Pro Tour, and B, the set comes out on Moto. Now, anybody has the ability to do something kind of specific, which is to just play, you know, draft after draft after draft, and regardless of anything else, if you hit your head against the wall enough times, you're gonna at least find out what beats you. You know, what consistently is happening?
In that case, it's the wall. It's the wall that's beating.
Yeah. No.
So
okay. So
yeah, that's the first window.
That's the first window, and then eventually, is there a point where?
Then there's a point where I think that I know. Whether I do or not, I think that I know what the general public believes is important in the format.
Okay.
At the very beginning, I just think that I know how to do a lot of the what a lot of the archetypes look like and some of the cards that are important in each of them. So I think that I can put that together in a draft environment better than people that don't. There's like the PT is a pretty big like first start to this, but then also the Moto. People start to put things together, and you know, even people that don't have access to a local draft environment have really put together a lot of drafts. They've drafted a lot of times, and there are some things that work for people. There have to be, and those things are likely talked about after the Pro Tour. A lot of people start to write articles or do draft videos, and they talk about, well, during our playtesting for the Pro Tour, this is what we thought the best color was. Or, you know, people start to come out with lists of cards that are like the best uncommon in this color, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and talk about archetypes. People are able to either generate that for themselves or able to read that information and consume it and get a lot better pretty quickly. And suddenly the entire community goes from being kind of a question mark to being like relatively competent. Everybody catches up to where we're at. And then the only thing that is different is that I don't just like accept that and go, all right, neat, and then stop drafting. I'm still drafting twice a week, still talking about what everybody else thinks that is good. And then like somebody is playing what everybody thinks is the best, and then we're beating it. We're finding ways of beating it. What's, you know, so the most Theros is, I'll talk about Theros. The most linear strategy is probably heroic, right? So like white X heroic. Well, for a good portion of online at the very beginning, nobody was drafting white. And then suddenly everybody was drafting White X Rock, right? So that's like one of the most overdrafted colors for a long time online. And that's something that, though I haven't experienced it firsthand, I happen to like be having conversations with people about what's going on, and I have a pretty good idea of, all right, well, white is overdrafted online, which means that if you try and force a heroic deck, you're going to be fighting with people, but it's also really deep, so you might be able to get there anyway. Well, what beats white X heroic decks? If you lose to everything that isn't that, but you can beat that, like, what kind of archetype does that? And the answer is, like, cards that you don't have to, rather than like just regular removal spells, cards like Asp, the 4/5 that has reach is really, really, really good against a Voltron, because now there are multiple cards that are a part of their creature, can like attack into it, half of their thing dies and the Asp is still alive, the other part attacks again, and it's like a multiple removal spells in one card. And cards like that in Scorpion put together can make an archetype that is very resilient against heroic. So yeah, Suddenly we're playing green when everybody else is playing white, and we're winning a lot still. So
yeah.
That's, you know, that's an example in terms of Toronto. I was like, all right, well, everybody's really high on white. I think green is the best color by a lot. Not sure what this, not by a lot is an overstatement. That's just magic hyperbole, because I can't get away from it. But I was specifically interested in playing green if it was available. And also knew that the general consensus was that red is terrible. That nobody wants to be red in a draft, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But knowing those two things, like in my second draft in Toronto, I sat at a table with Huey Jensen and Sam Black and like a bunch of high level pros and a couple people that maybe you'd never heard of, or I hadn't heard of, but I knew had won like a limited Grand Prix before. So bunch of people that are good and uninterested in being embarrassed. So I forced mono red and 3-0'd that draft, beating Sam Black in the last round, which is really awkward actually, because he's a friend of mine and he, like, we were car mates, and he was playing for his like fifth consecutive big high level top eight, and I was fighting for my, you know, first limited top eight.
He was a friend of yours.
Why would you do that to your friend? Yeah, you guys are.
Well, I like winning.
Yeah.
No, I mean it was just really unfortunate that we got paired against each other, because I wanted him to do well, and if he got paired against somebody else, then it wouldn't, we just wouldn't have to have the guarantee of, well, one of us is top A-ing this and one of us isn't.
Yeah, that stinks.
So anyway, I would not advocate on behalf of playing mono red, but I certainly was very confident going into that event, or into that draft specifically, that Sam, who was to my right, had heard me talking about like how much I favored green, and that I was not going to be getting green from the right. That he was going to just cut me off of green. Because he thought that green was reasonable, and because doing so was going to like directly affect a player to his left, which is what he should do. So I knew that I wasn't going to be getting green. And also knew that it was a table full of people that were uninterested in playing red. So I was able to capitalize as a result of that information. So going into that tournament, it wasn't so much that I felt like I'm totally insane. It was just that I think that I adequately understand what everybody else thinks about this format. And as a result, we'll be able to pick my spots to be able to utilize that information that is kind of meta information to be able to do well in this event. So there's this like second wave after there's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of information, and that information starts to converge together to be pretty obvious. I think that there's another spot where me and some of the people that I play with on a regular basis get really confident again, and that's because we at least know what you're thinking. And if we have a relatively similar amount of experience and I know what you're thinking and you don't necessarily know what I'm thinking, I think that I'm advantaged. So that's my long answer to another probably simple question.
I want to thank Greg for coming on the show this week and giving us some insight into what makes his play pretty darn great, in my opinion. It was awesome. I mean, to hear all of that, and I completely agree with the two phases of, you know, limited play and all that kind of stuff. You see the first wave and the second wave and all that jazz. And play groups, listeners out there, if you want to start your own, I highly encourage it. We've done a little bit of it here in Minneapolis, just between some Magic the Amateuring crews and others, and it's always been pretty beneficial in the end.
Totes. Yeah, and a lot of fun. So thanks for all of the background on getting one of those started and keeping them running consistently.
I hope to see you out in Sacramento, Greg. Are you going to be out there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Oh, awesome! Yes. You'll have to say hi. We'll all have to say hi.
Sounds good.
Because we will be out there as well. Cool. Mostly, we're going to be escaping Minnesota.
Yeah,
that's the main point. The
number. Yeah, the number one point is to escape Minnesota. The number two point is that we're also going to enjoy playing Magic.
Correct. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at MTAcast. Check out our website, magictheamateuring.com. Say hi on themeetery.org or shoot us an email, magictheamateuring@gmail.com, and subscribe on iTunes.
Yeah. Thank you again so much, Greg.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad to be on. I'm also on Twitter, G3NGR3G. It's like Jen Greg, but with threes. Anyway.
Awesome.
Sweet. We'll be following you.
We will find you on Twitter. We will find you.
Yeah, we'll make sure to retweet you so that anyone who follows us can follow you as well.
Cool. Yeah, that way they will have your info. Awesome. Well, keep chill, everybody. And by chill, I mean cool. And by cool, I mean not physically
warm.
Cold, but just
warm. Yeah, really warm. Yeah.
Keep warm.
Wrap yourself in a blanket made of magic cards that's insulated with maybe whale blubber, maybe some kind of animal fur. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
One of those things.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.